session as well. Thank you for your patience as well while we're getting that back up on the screen again. I'm a poet, and the main thrust of this particular presentation is giving you an overview of the work that I've been doing for the past 18 months as poet in residence with the Marine Conservation Society, working specifically on their 30 threatened species appeal. And I'd like to introduce you to some of the challenges that I've experienced in terms of encouraging people to write poems about predominantly cold-blooded creatures, and also some of the challenges that I've met in my own practice as a poet, because I have to write one poem, at least one poem for each of the 30 threatened species as well. So I'll be sharing a couple of those poems, or maybe three, at the end, towards the end of the presentation. So all of my work, probably for the past 10 years, has been rooted in the belief that poetry can make a difference, that it can inspire shifts in perception and create new patterns of thought and experience, so that if somebody establishes an emotional connection with a particular issue or with a particular endangered species through either writing the poem themselves or through reading or listening to a poem that I or a colleague may have written, that will lead to them developing a more enduring connection, hopefully, with that issue or that endangered species, which can potentially, hopefully, lead to behaviour change. This is something that runs through my three published collections, most recently Skin Dancing, which was published early this year, which is themed around human-animal, non-human animal metamorphosis, and both our intimacy with and alienation from our own animal selves and the wider animal world. I've also, I'll give you a little bit of background to the work that I've done with other organisations before leading to the cold-blooded work with the Marine Conservation Society. I've been involved with WWF's Earth Hour, which as most of you probably know is 1 hour in March every year when everyone is asked to switch off their lights for to celebrate the beauty of the planet. And the way that I've come in is that I've been asked to run workshops, poetry workshops, for school groups and for adults, predominantly in Wales, encouraging people to write poems around the impact of climate change on various species. Most of the species that we've looked at are the kind of iconic species like polar bears, Adélie penguins, and various other birds that are having their migration patterns, breeding and nesting routines interrupted by climate change. So I certainly haven't experienced any difficulties in terms of encouraging people to connect with these particular iconic species. And generally there will be a performance event at the end of this project with people reading the poems that they may have been written by candlelight when all the lights elsewhere are switched off. I've also been involved with Friends of the Earth Cymru working specifically on their bee cause. And this was a bit of a shift obviously from mammals and birds to insects to bees. Again, it followed a similar pattern in that I was running workshops for, predominantly for adults this time actually, writing poems myself and then leading to a celebration evening where poets, performers, storytellers, musicians and so on were brought together to celebrate bees through music, through words, through stories. And again, I found that people had no trouble whatsoever relating to the particular species that we were looking at here. And I think the reason for this is beautifully summed up, actually, in an essay by Elizabeth Lawrence, The Sacred Bee, the Filthy Pig, and the Bat Out of Hell. So that the bee who produces the precious substance and moreover exhibits such extraordinary social structure and behavioural traits came to be regarded as an exalted creature, ultimately sanctified and associated with life's central events, birth, marriage, and death, and with belief in resurrection. Bees were drawn into the human life cycle, regarded with awe and was perceived as possessing spiritual qualities and supernatural abilities. And I think those beliefs, which originated medieval times leading into Renaissance times and beyond, is still with us today. So again, I found that workshop participants were absolutely ready to connect with bees and write quite lengthy, enthusiastic, celebratory pieces around bees. And the impact of neonicotinoids on bee behaviour. And I think this is also, their connection with bees is also enhanced by the fact that Friends of the Earth Cymru at every opportunity gets their supporters to dress up in fluffy bee costumes. It gives the impression of them being quite fluffy, almost mammal-like creatures. And towards the end of these particular workshops and the projects, we would get such comments as the poetry expanded our vision, it was an opening up of our imagination and deepened our understanding of issues around wildlife conservation. And thanks to the poetry project, I'm now much more aware of the vulnerability of the ecosystems because of pollution and exposure to human need and greed, and I'm committed to do something about it. And that last line is really the key line for me. For example, at the end of the bee course, we had people planting wildflowers in their gardens and doing various other things in order to show their commitment. So now to my current work residency with Marine Conservation Society. Some of you may know the 30 Threatened Species Appeal evolved or came into being last year to coincide with their 30th birthday. And as an organisation, they've identified 30 species which are either resident in or visitors to UK waters, which are on the IUCN list of endangered species. So they are either endangered, critically endangered, threatened, near threatened. And or some of them, actually, the population is not known, but they obviously still need support. And in terms of how the species are divided, there are 3 bird species, 6 mammals, and all the rest are either marine reptiles or fish, and 9 of them are sharks. So there, you've got iconic species like the Atlantic puffin and like the bottlenose dolphin. You've also got the harbour seal, which, not surprisingly, the MCS has used as its poster boy for the campaign. But then you've got creatures like the angel shark, the frilled shark, and the undulate ray, which is so well camouflaged there that it's almost unseeable, and the pink sea fan, a soft coral. And to go back to the paper that we heard yesterday, where corals were described as being deemed to be environments in which other species live rather than creatures themselves, this has also been my experience in terms of reaction from participants in the workshop, that it's more plant-like than animal-like. This has been a particularly challenging one for people to associate with. However, it's really the sharks that people have most had problems with, and we've heard quite a lot about connection or lack of connection with sharks today. In fact, one of my workshop participants sent me this article only this week. It was from the Daily Telegraph, it's prefaced by this gory shark photograph. It's talking about the influx of shark attacks in Australia, particularly and Mike Baird, the state premier of New South Wales, talking about the fact that we're seeing some of the toughest people on the planet up there on the far north coast, who take on some of the biggest and most treacherous waves without even blinking, in a position where they are now very fearful to go in the water. He added that the mood on some parts of the coast had moved from joy to fear, and said we need to take that away. And even though the sharks that we're looking at as part of this particular project are not that kind of shark at all, still people have this assumption that that's what they're going to have to think about when they're writing about shark poems. So the mammals, in terms of writing poems of celebration, appreciation, haven't caused any problems at all. People say, at first I said to people, I gave them a free rein when they were coming along to workshops, and said you can pick any one of the 30 species to write about. I did end up with an absolute being overwhelmed by bottlenose dolphins, perhaps not surprisingly. And people's rationale was such things as watching dolphins off the coast of West Wales makes me feel less depressed. They give me a sense of joy and peace. I used to see harbour seals all the time when I was growing up near Dundee. Whenever I see them now, I think back to my childhood and feel happy, and that makes me want to help them. Very human-centred reasons, of course, rather than seeing the creatures in their own right. Very, very human-centred. Anthropocentric reasons for writing poems and wanting to connect with the creatures, but still it is a way in. It's for people. This is in stark contrast to the fish poems that I've now been encouraging people to write. I just can't get excited about fish. I don't think about them that much, and they're not very attractive. I find sharks are a bit threatening. I'd rather write about something that doesn't seem so sinister. And the angel shark is so unusual. I've never heard of it before. I don't know how to express anything about it. So what can we do within the context of the workshop space in order to make people feel that they can write about it, the angel shark and other species? I hoped that people would find or enjoy that sense of wonder and go in with a sense of being fascinated by that difference and celebrate the difference. But I've only had limited success going in from that angle. And as an example, I'll share a few stanzas from a poem about an angel shark that somebody in the Hereford workshop wrote. And her way of connecting with the angel shark was to domesticate it, to use metaphors and similes which come directly from our own human experience. You're not a shark that swims into nightmares at 3 a.m. with a jaw hinged like the boot of an estate car. You're a snub-nosed flying carpet of rubber muscle whiffling over the seabed, or resting in a sand hollow, comfy as a cat. And I think that last image is absolutely evident, or evidence of that, that move to domesticate and take the wildness away. I thought that this particular species, I thought both the short-snouted seahorse and the long-snouted seahorse might actually draw people in more than some of the other fish, perhaps because of its kind of equine mammalian facial features and that curiosity at the fact that it's the male that that is pregnant and give birth to the young. I thought that, that would really draw people in and people would want to really sort of take that on board. But again, it's been quite challenging encouraging people to embrace that that sense of curiosity and fascination. One way that I've been working around seahorses actually is to put the theme and the creature to one side temporarily and go in from the angle of working through the techniques of the poetry, and particularly through sound. So if we are thinking about a seahorse that is comfortable in its habitat, think about using patterns of soft sounds, sibilants and labials, S's and L's. And then if we're then talking about something bad happening to the seahorse, start to integrate hard sounds, the gutturals, the G's and K's, and plosives, the PBs and T's that explode out of the front of the mouth. And I was interested to see if this approach, going in through the technique, would actually lead, if people actually went through that process, it would then mean that they did establish a connection with the creature by the end of that process. And interestingly, that has generally happened. I will share briefly a few examples of that, again from a participant in the Hereford workshop. Her poem is called Hippocampus. I've probably got time to read the whole thing, actually. So you can listen out for those soft sounds in the early stanzas. Also a repetition of quite a harsh vowel sound, which is the sound, which is repeated all the way through. Shift from active to passive verbs, and then finally the hard plosives and gutturals in the last stanza. Hidden in wafting seagrass, he's on his own, small, inquiring eye relaxed. Stirring currents lull him, he holds on by coiled tail, sways with the swell, dreaming of his unborn brood, still safe. A minute pulse alerts, unnerves him. A water whisper grows, spreads through him. The seagrass leans, keels, is dragged, pulled, wrenched, torn from the sand. Streaming in a tumble of murky green, he's whirled to the surface, grabbed, got one. And interestingly, this particular writer has become quite involved in seahorse conservation, which is very pleasing. Something else that, or one angle that I've also been able to take in terms of two species of fish, the Atlantic bluefin tuna and the European sturgeon, is to draw people's attention to Rewilding Britain, the new charity that's launched earlier this summer. Their mission being to see at least 1 million hectares of Britain's land and 30% of our territorial waters supporting natural ecological processes and key species. And they've nominated a number of key species, and among the wolves, the lynx, the beavers and so on, you can see the bluefin tuna and the European sturgeon. And actually talking about this as a possibility, rewilding and reintroduction, has actually really grabbed people's interest. And I think it's partly as a relief against focusing on loss, which is something that these workshops are doing a lot. So if people can actually see the potential for something positive, that's actually been quite a successful route into writing about these particular creatures. So, what about my own writing? I got underway with the writing. I'm about halfway through the 30 species at the moment. And I got underway with the writing of the poems before I ran or planned any of the workshops. So I hadn't really processed in my own head the whole question of writing about cold-blooded creatures. I tried not to overthink at the beginning, in fact. I just looked at the 30 species that were there and went for any ones that particularly grabbed me to start off with. And I fell into the trap. I went straight for the bottlenose dolphin. Perhaps unsurprisingly, I live on the coast of West Wales. I see bottlenose dolphins quite regularly. And I've been a volunteer on the boats that that go out dolphin spotting. And what I wanted to explore in this particular poem, and I'm going to share this this mammalian poem with you, so that hopefully over the course of the three poems, you can see the shift from absence of the cold-blooded creature to presence by the end of the three poems. In this, I wanted to explore the fetishization, our fetishization of dolphins, and how we look to them to heal us. There's a whole organisation in the States talking about dolphin healing energy, and the fact that sometimes on these dolphin spotting boats, people actually get very angry if the dolphins fail to show up. And there's a real sort of rumblings of discontent and people mumbling about the fact they want their money back. And I also wanted to explore the process of metamorphosis and transformation so that the people on this particular boat in the poem actually manifest dolphin tendencies themselves. So this is called Fluke. For the first half hour, we synchronise our binos and our grey mistakes when spying rocks and rats. 1 hour in, we vow to veto tuna. Our guide tries to toss stouts aside and strand them on a spit, but spirits sag like jellyfish. We hold our breath for 8 minutes, start to navigate the deck by clicks. A woman who's fixed what we insist is joy on her lips offers up the crystals which cling to her neck and wrists. Mid-trip, still no sign, so our guide's obliged to summon Poseidon, but he comes without his ride. While a guy who's dived in Cairns and Thailand yawns, shuts down half his brain and waits to name his thumb after a thermos. Then, just as our pod of time leaps by, my eyes, I find, can breach the t-shirts, shirts, the flops and flips, can see the part-digested chips, the seeds of refund pleas, the woman's peak at her lack of healing. A child, her stomach stuffed with bubble rings, begins to cry. My first fish poem was The Common Skate. I think what I find interesting now when I look at the poem is the fact that it's not really about the common skate at all. The common skate actually just makes a very brief appearance at the end. I had to call upon a whole entourage of mammals and birds before I could get to the common skate. In this poem, I've imagined an afterworld in which many extinct animals, animals that have become extinct as a result of human activity, have gathered and speculate onto what which animals may be next. So this is Afterworld. Here all animals are equal, equal in extinction. The mower, long ago and is no more, dozes with the golden toad. The aurochs shoulders the load of the great orc. The quagga logs all recent arrivals, the western black rhino, shorn of her horn, lonesome George crawling from the island himself, the Spix's macaw clawing at reports of captive survivors. The Pyrenean ibex takes vertiginous bets on who's next. The Caspian tiger's wild striped des says the pygmy three-toed sloths outpacing himself, racing past the red edge of his mangroves, while dead glaciers wait for the kiss of the snow leopard's tread. And look, here's the common skate, swimming against the tide of her name, cartilaginous kite, snarled in infinite promises. Yeah, I haven't got time to do the Pink Sea Fan, but I will briefly tell you where I am with the writing at the moment. I'm exploring language and thinking about which is something I've been thinking about for quite a number of years, actually, how to give voice to a creature without overt anthropomorphism, without giving a creature a solid, stable, first-person I. And a poet who's been very inspiring for quite a number of us who are writing in this area is Les Murray, particularly his 93 collection, Translations from the Natural World, where he plays with language, plays with grammar, plays with the rules of grammar. For example, in this poem Pigs, us on all sorts of meant was we, not warm there with glares, not glutting mush under that pole the lightning's tied to, no farish it in milk to make us randy. All through that poem, he's using the object pronoun us as a subject pronoun because the pigs have no agency. So I'm in the latest slew of poems that I'm writing, I'm exploring language and trying to create new languages for the various creatures, such as the poor beagle shark. I'll just read a couple of stanzas from this. I'm attracted to the poor beagle shark, again, for quite a human reason. It's the shark that's the most playful, apparently. So I wanted to try and get that sense of play into the language. And not, actually, I don't use a pronoun at all. Love being on the cusp of tooth, love quick swim and squidding, love egging little finniness, thousand egging. Love best when frondling kelp, the over-under roll, and oh, the gilly tingle. Not just skin-ridding, not just snail-full, but wrap and tangle, tag and tug, all feely with it. Love sillying the timbers, love snouting the floaters till they pop. I'll finish by just drawing your attention, if I may, to a magazine, an online digital magazine of writing that I co-founded with a colleague back in March, actually. And it's a magazine of writing in celebration and defence of wild animals. And I'm mentioning it primarily because of the fact that we've had very, very few submissions on cold-blooded animals. The third issue, which we launched on World Animal Day on Sunday, I had about 400 poetry submissions, because I'm poetry editing for it. Of those, only 23 were cold-blooded animals. And in fact, I've only found so far three publishable poems for across the three issues, one about a horseshoe crab, one about a spider, and another about a dragonfly. So I am aiming to actually devote one issue next year to cold-blooded creatures, because I really want to try and somehow redress the balance. So put out a call for submissions for just poems and prose on cold-blooded creatures. So thank you very much for listening, and I'd be really happy to take questions.